Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Oh, we're still here.
That's nice, Dane.
I do.
Hugh Hefner's widow, Crystal Hefner, says he went deaf in one ear from using too much Viagra before he said... No wonder you can't hear me, Ralph. No wonder.
Twist his mic up. Twist like a motorbike. No. Look at my hand.
What?
Twist like a motorbike. There we go.
Oh.
Give me a level.
How's that come across?
That's like a professional. This part two of Hump Day with Swanee and Friends, and we're very, very excited because someone's agreed to lower his lofty standards to join us. From Champion Data, Daniel Hoyne. Thank you very much for coming in.
Ralphie, how are you going?
Wonder where this podcast would rank on Champion Data.
Pretty low,
I would imagine. Yeah.
So, Jared Healy often uses the quote from Glenn Luff, who started with you guys. Without data, you're just a flog with an opinion.
Mm.
And Dane uses a phrase which is... Is Nick Natanui still your number one player?
That phrase.
I reckon the answer's somewhere in the middle.
No, it's a pleasure to be here, Dane.
We're
sort of stepping into uncharted Champion Data waters, if you like, coming in here today. But we're looking forward to it. It's plenty to talk about.
Well, King and Jared are massive believers. And so when I was 100 years ago, when I was in the footy media, it was Eddie McGuire and Dennis Pagan who embraced Ted Hopkins' work. This is in the mid-90s.
Yep.
And Ted was a bit of a pioneer in your field. Mm. But there's always that sort of step between the skeptics of trust your eye, and I probably went through this journey with horse racing a bit, and the reality of, yes, there is information there if you want to look for it and get it. So how is it from your side of the fence?
Yeah, so our whole purpose is that, you know, we're here to tell the story of the game, if you like. But we always come at it that there is a combination of trust your eye, but then also have the evidence behind you to actually sort of, you know, justify, you know, the opinions or, you know, the beliefs that you're looking to actually make, if you like. So a lot of people will have their own thoughts, which is fair enough. Mm-hmm. And then the data is there to either sort of, you know, back up that thought or potentially actually have a look at a way to actually go about, a different philosophy, if you like. So there is always that combination of both. And that's what I sort of stress, you know, a lot about. Yeah, everyone just assumes that we are just absolute numbers. And yes, we are sort of, are absolutely coming from that background, but you have to have that, you know, that knowledge of the eye as well to be able to actually, you know, sort of bring the two, you know, into tandem to actually, you know, inherit and actually, you know, sort of bring out your actual overall opinion and thoughts.
And how did you cope with that during your career as what we would term a natural footballer, Dane?
Well, I was probably more of a natural footballer. Sam Mitchell would probably be a natural footballer. My numbers weren't great for me, but especially my kicking efficiency and stuff like that. That's why I had to get it a lot to have an effective game, because those weren't real high. But I think I went okay in Champion Data stats every now and then.
Well, I have done a little bit of research.
Good.
And I thought I have to do a bit of research on Swanee here.
So it depends how well this comes across before I start unloading the barrels. Let's just see. This might be a very easy half an hour if you say the right things.
I can take it both ways. So we'll start with a positive. We're on a bit of a positive path.
Okay.
But there's a lot of, you know, sort of numbers that we do look at, to be able to sort of, you know, really analyse player performance. And, you know, contested possessions gets talked about a lot. You know, it's been, you know, sort of that real hard and sort of, you know, sort of tough metric, if you like. But there are sort of multiple ways that you can win a contested possession. And the pin-up contested possession for us is the loose ball. So the loose ball is, you know, a ball that is in dispute, but that player just wins it a second or two before he's actually under physical pressure. So being able to really identify where the ball's gone, you know, sort of faster than his opponent. And then that possession allows you to make a really effective decision.
So fast of mind and fast of foot.
Fast of mind, fast of foot. Yeah. And the bloke on the right, he was the pin-up. He was the pin-up.
You've got him down. Oh,
so we'll start in the positive here. Like,
well, yeah, so it's going to be easy.
So over a five-year period, as I said, you were the pin-up boy for us. 150 more loose balls you won than any other player in the competition over a five-year period. So
end the podcast there. That'll do. That'll be great.
I'm worried everything's going to roll down to be here in a minute.
Still couldn't make it in the Hall of Fame.
Have you got a reason why? Can we work out why he's not in the Hall of Fame? Yeah. Give us that data by the end of the show.
Swanny, I could put forward a good case for
you.
Comfortably. But there were many numbers, if you like. The kicking efficiency component, as you said, wasn't high.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
But the way that we measure kicking isn't by kicking efficiency, it's our kick rating system. And the kick rating system had you coming out above AFL average. So,
thank you. I actually really like champion data. I think they've done a great job.
So I thought we'll start positive. Yeah, we'll try and get you on board.
So break that down for the average punter. And we are very average on our general listeners. What does that mean, kicking rating and fishing?
Yeah, so someone like a Swanee, for instance, and, you know, like a Tim Taranto and a Dusty and these sort of guys, you know, they're under a lot of pressure a lot of the time when they're actually, you know, sort of disposing the ball by foot. So that's where, you know, the kicking efficiency measure actually is a little bit misleading.
Try to kick out of a stoppage where you've got three blokes on you. Yeah, if it goes to a bloke who's sitting behind the ball, it's not your fault, it's the forward's fault for not fucking getting a spoil down.
But then you look at, you know, sort of, you know, like your key defenders that you would have played with, you like, yeah, you know, a lot of the time they're under no pressure and they're going short 15 metres, 20 metres, and their kicking efficiency is going to be, you know, 90 to 100%. It's quite misleading.
Let's say, just hypothetically, a retired champion goes and starts playing a lot in suburban and country footy for a little income. He would then go to the half-back line and just kick and improve his kicking efficiency.
Yeah, 100%.
And the game's also a lot slower, so it's easier to hit targets. I actually fucked a few up on the weekend, actually. So don't review my game on the weekend. It was horrific.
Give us the tape, mate. We'll go back and we'll enhance that for you.
So that's the case for?
Yeah, so then, the kick rating side of things takes into account how much pressure you're actually under. So, you know, someone like a Swanee or a Tim Taranto this year where, you know, he has been criticised, they're under a lot of pressure, so their sort of kick rating or kicking efficiency measure should be around about the 50 to 45, you know, sort of percent mark, if you like. So that sort of return is what you should be expecting given how much pressure they're actually under. So it's, there's different ways to actually measure how effective a player is by foot.
And also he was a pioneer, if you like, of... or with Mick about with the ice hockey get in, rotations. Do your stuff, rotation and all that. So what did you see when you were starting to measure that?
Well, I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to say this, but so, you know, we're doing a bit of work with Bucks this year. Yeah. And I hit him up saying, I'm coming on the podcast here. Can you just give us anything with Swanee? And he said, oh, mate, he goes, where do you want me to start? Anyway, and he did mention to me that in 2007, towards the back end of the year, you played against Sydney, and Sydney were going to be a really hard one-on-one, and they were going to go hard on you, from a tagging perspective. And then, was it David Butterford was your fitness sort of coach then? And they came up with a strategy to, okay, well, we're sort of, you know, really going to throw it back on them, or we're just going to rotate Swanee just heavily, and we're just going to just throw them around, and you know, it completely lost them. And then from that stage on, that's when Collingwood sort of, you know, just instigated this high rotation policy that our interchange operators were just absolutely stuffed.
So some would say we ruined football because apparently AFL didn't like the aesthetics of people running off and on. Probably give you a lot more work to do.
Oh, mate, gave us grief. Yeah, mate, we're just sitting there and just doing 30, 40 rotations and, you know, it's the easiest job in the world. And all of a sudden the 2007 final series comes along. It's like, what the hell's going on here?
We're about 160 or something.
Oh, mate, we're getting about 100. And then 2010, when you win the flags, about 150. 106. It's the world's hardest job on the back of you, just trying to actually to get you on and off the ground to actually, you know, sort of lose your opponent. So thanks for that.
No worries. I was the most rotated bloke in the league for like 3 years. Yeah.
And what? How was that sold to you?
Well, sold to me, like basically like that is a good way to break a tag, keep you fresh. They obviously created it to my running strength. So my running strength is not your Penelbury or your Sidebottom, like a Robert Harvey who could run all day basically at the same speed and wear someone down, and by the end of the game, the bloke he was playing on was fucked and he could just dominate. That wasn't me. Mine was like, I can, you know, if I could see, whenever it was pre-season, if I could see, he goes, run to that cone and you get a 20-second break, well, I want to be first there so I can get a break quicker than anyone else.
Yeah.
But if I run for 7 minutes, I'd be like, mentally, I just like, this fucking sucks. So it was, my pace was like short, sharp, get on, do my thing for 5, 6, 7 minutes, then have a 2-minute break, and I could recover, I guess, maybe quicker than others. So that they decided, well, we need, if we can keep him running like that at the end of the game, you know, that'll be a good way. And also as a way to break a tag and keep fresh legs in there. So you got 6 or 7 blokes who are all fresh and using their speed and stuff like that in a game. And then the opposition have got 3 or 4.
Yep.
So by the end of the game, you've got blokes who are obviously not some super fresh, but pretty fresh on the blokes who have been playing in there the whole day. And you just wear them down and you obviously just run over the top of them. So that's basically what it was. And it got sold to me. And I didn't really, you know, when you're a good player or when you're one of the prime players, no one wants to come off. Like I started my era. You started on the bench. I've come on for Bucks at the 23-minute mark. I'd play 7 minutes, a quarter to go. Then I'd go back to the bench.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck that. What do I want to go to the bench for? Like, and, you know, without people, you're thinking, well, mate, I'm a chance to win best and fairest and all Australians and, like, Brownlows. Like, mate, if I'm on the bench, I can't get I'm on the bench. So that, and I was at the start, I was like, no. Like, I don't really agree to it, but then it just worked. Yeah. And, yeah, so it worked, so I was stuck.
It is interesting now, though, because, you know, if you ever look at what a lot of the best players in the competition are doing that have that profile, a lot of them are doing what you were doing 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, Dangerfield last year often started, you know, the game on the bench and then, you know, would just go on for 5 minutes, come off. And this year, at the start of every game, he's on, but then he's off 3 minutes in, and then he's just constantly going on. Paul Adelaide do that with Zach Butters.
Yep.
Just go on for burst, come off, freshen up, go back on for a burst sort of thing. So it is interesting, sort of where that's actually gone over the last, sort of 10 to 15 years.
It depends on the year. You play like Dangerfield, he's a power player.
Yeah.
Like someone like Scott Penner, he doesn't need to come off. He can... Mm.
He can't get any slower
as the day gets longer. Yeah. So it just depends on your midfield. So you need those explosive plays. You need them to keep them fresh because at the end of the game, you know, what their strengths are, if they don't have them anymore, they're not rendered useless, but they certainly won't be as influential at the end of a game if they're knackered by the end of it and they've got too much lactic build up and they can't run away from people when that's their strength, then, you know, there's no point being out there.
All right. So you've build him up.
Did
he have any weaknesses?
Bring me back a bit.
Well, yeah, we brought in our pressure ratings from 2010, onwards, and
this is not bringing me back. I have no problem saying that I wasn't good at pressure. That didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, and what is it? The first 6 years, and when did you win a Brownlow? 10 or 11?
11. Well, I should have won a 10, 11 and 12, but no, 11 I won it. Yeah.
Why'd I ask?
Yeah.
And, yeah, so all the Brownlow medalists, bar two in the first 6 years of our pressure rating sort of systems, you know, sat in the top 50 of the pressure players in the comp.
50? What are they? They're kidding themselves.
It's not a high rating, but just, you know, sort of top 50.
Can I guess the other one?
Who's the other one?
So what is it between? When were you 6 years?
So 2010 to 2015. So we had 6. So we had Mitchell, we had yourself, had Judd.
I want to say Mitchell was great at pressure.
No, he was in there. Matty Prittis. Matty Prittis was in there.
Ablett.
You're in good hands. No, Gazza was in there.
Was he?
Yeah, Gazza was in there.
I don't got many left. Judd.
Chris Judd. So Chris Judd and yourself are the only two Brownlow medalists in the first 6 years of the pressure rating system
counter, so it's hard when you got the ball to put pressure on. That's what I would say.
I like that, but I reckon Gazza won a bit of it.
Let's stop fucking worrying about Gaz. Gaz is not Gaz's podcast. Yeah, no, he got it a lot, didn't he? Yeah.
So, just a hypothetical, I got a message from a mate last night called Dane, who was a bit mystified by Jack Sinclair's your number one player. Mm. So, not just about Jack Sinclair, but about the broader... Yeah.
And you said the eye test and stuff. Surely you can look at the footy and say, and he's a very good player, but you're Australian, like... He ain't the best player in the league. That's just a fact.
And that's a fair debate. That's a fair debate. And this is where you know the eye test and and the data sort of, you know, sort of come in line. You know, like we did our All Australian team last night on radio, and we had Sam Sukowski.
Yeah, no, I've got that too. I literally don't know who that is.
Number 39 for Fremantle. He goes okay. A little small forward.
He might go okay. He doesn't go well enough to be in the top 22 at the end of the season, let me tell you.
So he's not going to be in the All-Australian team, and fair enough.
Yeah.
But he's in yours.
I get that. Yeah. Right? I wouldn't have him in my All-Australian team, but we've got to go off what the data's telling us, and the data's telling us that he's had a really good year.
What position does he play?
A little small forward thing. So that's where I'd be looking at it from, you know, a Fremantle side of thing, a player management side of thing, and an opposition club going, okay, well, yeah, we're not seeing him as All-Australian level, but clearly he's going okay. Let's actually dive into him a little bit more to actually see why he's actually going so well off the numbers, if you like. Getting back to the Jack Sinclair point as well. So what we're sort of trying to do, and it is, and yeah, I'm not sure if you agree or not with this, Dane, as well, it's getting harder and harder to actually, you know, analyse players by one position.
So we're
seeing, you know, if you use the Nick Dacos example, we're seeing him play across halfback flank for the first, you know, sort of 10 weeks of the year. Now he's played, you know, permanent midfield for the last 10 weeks of the year. We have to give him one position, if you like. And it's sort of a little
Why do you have to do that?
That's just how everything works in the back end. Okay. That's far smarter people than me. But we have to give them one position, so we have to give them their overall primary position, which sort of then, you know, we're benchmarking Nick Dacos against Paddy Cripps, if you like. Paddy Cripps playing 100% midfield time. Nick Dacos this year spent, you know, sort of 50% midfield time. A little bit misleading. What we're trying to do now is remove that element and just look at how many minutes they play down back, how many minutes did they play in the midfield, and how did they go in each position based against AFL average expectation in each position, if you like.
So is that like expected scores?
A little bit.
Park expected scores, because I want to ask you about that to break it down for people.
So basically what we're trying to get to is, like, you know, if you're playing as a defender, right,
and you
get 20 disposals, that's a pretty good game for a defender. But if you get 20 disposals as a midfielder, you go, well, that's a pretty poor game as a midfielder. So that's what we're sort of trying to get to, that we're trying to level everything up based on where you've actually
played. But a possession's loss, so if you kick the ball out 15 times and you have 20 possessions, you've basically had five. So is that...
Yeah, it's a bit
cheap. Is that misleading, or is your back end figure that out?
Yeah, so our rating system is based on the AFL player ratings, which just measures impact on matches. Yeah. It measures how you win the ball, where on the ground you win the ball, and then what you do with the ball. Yeah. So those cheap kick-ins, you don't worry about it with the AFL player ratings, because you're not really impacting the game, if you like.
So that would be the difference between, say, the fantasy-type players who loved this match.
Yeah, no, that's why I played. Yeah, that was my strength. I was the first fantasy pick, as they say, yeah.
But also the data at the background that also says why Dane was elite, but others, then there's the ones who get through the system, you're actually saying, no, this bloke is important.
Yeah, correct. So that's what we're measuring. All we're trying to measure is the impact that you have on matches. There'll be some games, like, you know, for instance, you know, like Dusty this year, you know, like Dusty's season this year has been off the charts, really. And I don't think he's had the recognition that he deserves. No,
that's what I mean.
So he's playing in a position where he's spending 85% of his time outside of the midfield. And he's averaging 24 disposals a game, which we've never seen anyone on record do that before, by spending 85% or
records
more.
Records go back to roughly?
15 years.
Fantastic.
So we haven't seen anyone do that before. His ability to be able to impact the game from a score, assist, area, and then a score involvement area is top five in the competition. So his ability to be able to impact it, and this is, you know, sort of my theory with Dusty and you know, a lot of the greats, is that we're comparing, or people are comparing Dusty to Dusty.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they're not comparing Dusty to the competition.
Yeah.
If you compare Dusty to the competition, Dusty is a walk-up All-Australian selection this year.
But he probably won't
because it is so hard for people to actually remove Dusty's previous season's performances and just purely look at what he's done in 2023.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I get it. I appreciate that it's so hard. But if you just did that, you're looking to go, and then I heard Andrew McGualter on Sunday night just go, he's had a ridiculous season where he has to be All-Australian.
Yep.
But I've got the feeling that he won't be All-Australian.
So how does, and on these men, how did Christian Petrarca miss the top 10, for instance?
He was 11th. He was 11th.
That's how he missed. He was 11th.
He was 11th. There was about 70 players that were 11th.
Yep. But in actual fact, like when we do our stupid top 10 list on whatever fucking topic, and so I say, but what about such and such? Well, okay, but who do you take out? And then, so what you're actually doing, well, there's the measurement.
Yeah.
So, yep. so the, They're somewhere in the ranking.
Yeah, they are. So, yeah, so we had, Christian Petracca at 11th and then Toby Green at 12th.
Yep.
So, yeah, so they're probably the two that were the biggest overlooked. Yeah, and then you go to the, to the eye test as well, and I'll be sitting there going, well, I'm probably picking Toby Green, if not one, two, or three.
Yeah.
You know, in that order.
Yep.
So that's where, you know, again, you got to mirror the two of them up to actually, you know, come together to actually put,
Here's one for you. How does Josh Dacos not make your All-Australian team?
Good question. I was really hoping when I was putting it together yesterday that he was, because me and the Collingwood faithful don't really get along at the moment. But then I saw it and I'm like, oh no.
He would. It's probably one of the five locks, you think, for him and Gordon are probably everyone's wingman.
Yep.
What is he? And he's obviously a lovely kick, I would imagine.
So Gordon was clearly the number one rated winger in the competition. And then Mason Wood and Josh Dacos were just inches apart in terms of in terms of who got in based on the rating system, if you like. So the separating factor was, you know, that Josh uses the ball better than what Mason Wood does. Mason Wood sort of impacts the game more from his ball winning perspective than what Josh does. The only separating factor, and it was marginal, it's just their defensive actions. There was just a slight favour to Mason Wood than what there was Josh Dacos. But again, sort of, you know, if I'm looking at that team and I'm picking Josh Dacos, you go, no problem. That's fine.
So it's well known the Brownlow is basically a midfielder's award, to dumb it down a bit. But earlier this year, Dale Thomas said that Nick Dacos is the best player in the league. And you said, come on, please, Jeremy Cameron, when he was in that form, is.
Yeah.
Where do you think, from a numbers point of view, the reality is between the importance of a gun forward who wins games and the midfielder who keeps getting it down there?
Oh, I think, I think you've got to measure the impact of both.
Of course.
But I think at the end of the day, I get that, you know, people want to see, you know, different positions recognised, if you like, in the individual awards, but end of the day, like this final series that's coming up, like if you know, and you go to Collingwood Melbourne Thursday night, if Collingwood's midfield dominate, Collingwood are going to win.
Yes.
And if Melbourne's midfield dominate, Melbourne are going to win.
Yep.
The game could almost just be as simple as that. That if your midfield doesn't perform to a high level, you know, against the best and throughout a whole season, the chances of you having success are pretty slim. So yes. Yeah, so as good as what Jeremy Cameron was unbelievable in the first eight weeks of the year. And you could easily mount a case as him being the best player in the competition. But I think overall, constantly that's why we see the midfielders up so highly, is because that they're the ones that have the first opportunity to influence the game and to determine which way the game's going to go for your team. So I get it, and I can understand the conversation, but I'm taking a gun mid. First and foremost, in a final series. I mean, if I look at it...
So you take him over like a Charlie Kerno, who you take Petrarca or Nick Dacos, he was in full flight over Charlie Kerno, for instance, in this final series?
I would. Sort of Charlie's the exception because Charlie's just unbelievable in terms of what he's doing, but I am still going to go the midfielder. I mean, I'll look at it from a Collingwood perspective. I know Nick's going to miss the first final, but say, for instance, you know, sort of... Jordan Degaulle, for instance, his finals record is unbelievable. If he goes bananas for 3 weeks,
good luck.
Collingwood are probably going to win the flag.
Yep.
Like that's where I'm sort of looking at. Charlie goes bananas, and you go, okay, well, Charlie's going to be every chance. But then, you know, if Paddy Cripps goes bananas for, you know, on Friday night against Sydney, you go, well, probably Carlton are going to win.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I use a phrase and tell me where it's right or wrong or whatever, but the most, and it backs up what Dane says about dealing with pressure up forward, the most underrated part of footy is actually kicking the goal. The most overrated is everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've still got to measure it. So from your perspective, where do you see that? Because unless you nail the goal, it doesn't matter how good Nick Dacos or Christian Petrarca was getting the ball there, that goal has to be nailed.
Accuracy is everything, really. Yep. I mean, accuracy so often in home and away, but more so in finals over time, has either won a final or lost a final. I mean, like, you look at these final series coming up and these matches coming up, they're so close and they're so tight between the opponents coming up that it could be as simple as accuracy can determine it. You know, yep. Brisbane's finals record, and everyone will go on about Brisbane's final record, you know, has been pretty poor. Accuracy has killed them.
Yes.
In finals. It's really hurt them, you know, in finals. So that's where, you know, if you look, it's so basic, it's so simple, but we so often overlook it, and it's just so important.
So we get a lot of these things from different sports, which leads to expected score.
Yeah.
Firstly, dumb it down for the people who don't understand expected score and what it actually means.
Yeah, so getting back to the accuracy side of things, given how important it is and just, you know, the fact that it does win and lose a lot of games, we were sort of sitting here, you know, 10, 15 years ago going, well, we have to do a bigger piece and a bigger deep dive on accuracy just to be able to sort of really break down overall performance, if you like. And then, you know, it was more sort of, you know, and it still is, starting from a club perspective. So often I would have thought as a coaching group, your role as a coaching group is to develop a system where, you know, you've been able to actually generate the shots at goal, yep. if you like. And then it's over to Charlie Curnow to kick it. And then it's over to Harry McKay to kick it. And then it's over to Taylor Walker to kick it. And you, as a coach in the coaching box, have really no influence whether or not Charlie's going to kick that goal or not. But you do have influence of, you know, whether or not they're actually going to be able to generate enough shots through your ball movement game, your defence, mm-hmm. whatever it might be. So then, you know, we sort of basically simplified it to actually go back over time and every single shot at goal mm-hmm. and how much pressure they're actually under and where they're taking it from. How often has that goal been kicked? So say, for instance, in real simple terms, if Charlie Curnow takes a mark next Friday night and it's 25 metres out straight in front of goal, based on the last 10, 15 years' worth of data, you should be kicking that goal 75% of the time. So 75%, which is, you know, what is that, 3 out of 4 times, that equates to 4.5 points out of 6,
yep.
if you like. So 75% of 6 points. So he's meant to be getting 4.5 points from that kick, if you like. So if he kicks that goal,
yep.
he's kicked 1.5 above expectation. If yep. he kicks the behind, he's kicked 3.5 points.
So the other Charlie from Brisbane, when he kicks one out of his backside, how does that get measured?
So then if he kicks a goal on the boundary line from 50 metres out and the chances of kicking that goal were 20%, if yep. you like, which is, you know, just rough measures, you know, AFL average is 1 point, he kicks the goal. Brisbane have actually kicked 5 points above expectation based on that shot at goal. If he kicks the one behind, that's what was actually expected. Charlie, yes. don't worry about that shot. That's fine.
So then at the end of the game,
yep.
what's the importance of it?
So at the end of the game, it's more from a coaching tool to be able to actually strip back the accuracy component and just go, okay, so how did our actual overall system work? Did we actually generate easy enough shots at goal, or did we actually generate hard enough shots at goal that we can look at it and you go, okay. So I reference Chris Scott against Collingwood in the 2019 final, where Collingwood beat them yep. By 15 points or 10 points, whatever it might have been. And he referenced that tool, you know, sort of to his playing group during the week when everyone was sort of really down on Geelong, you know, another's finals loss and whatever. He referenced the expected scores to that group all week and said, we actually did a lot right here. We actually generated easier shots at goal than what Collingwood did. We just didn't take our opportunities.
Yes.
If we take our opportunities again, based on what we've done this year, we'll be okay, boys. We'll be okay. And then, you know, they came out the week after and beat West Coast by 5 goals, whatever it was, just to sell that message to the playing group. Don't get too down about this performance. We're actually okay, despite, you know, sort of, you know, the loss that they had.
I just wonder from a psychological point of view, I've got no idea here. I'm just observing, like Data's been there, where the fine line is then between giving the coaching group an out for forwards who don't nail the goal,
yep.
but then conversely saying, well, no, we're playing properly. We're just not,
yeah.
not kicking. Because in golf, you can't win a tournament if you can't putt.
Yeah, no, 100%. And it sort of works both ways too, Ralphie, because, you know, Adam Simpson and West Coast, they were always super accurate in front of goal. So they were always coming up really high on expected scores, and people were looking at going, well, you know, are they kicking out of their ass? Is that why they're actually yep. winning? And Adam Simpson would come to us, which was absolutely a fair point. And he goes, no, I get where the story is coming from, but we've actually got really accurate kicks for goal. So we're actually happy to take difficult shots.
Yes.
So we're actually happy for Josh Kennedy to take him, and Jack Darling to take him, and Jamie Cripps to take him, and Liam Ryan to take him, because they're all accurate.
Yeah.
Which is Fair enough. So they played to their strengths of having really accurate players in front of goal, where their sort of, you know, expected scores, if you like, were a little bit misleading, you know, on the positive.
So you'd have expected score teammates that you would expect them to kick and not to kick. But I mean, yeah, at the moment, absolutely. Jamie Elliott's probably the one.
Clutch,
isn't he?
Yeah. He kicks the big ones and are very important. Mm. Jamie, he's Collingwood's highest rated player, didn't you say?
Yeah, he over the last 6 weeks, he's the highest rated player at the moment. So he's going extremely well. In terms of his target return inside forward 50 and his ability to be able to mark it, but then more importantly, the rating system that we have significantly rewards great accuracy.
Yep.
And significantly punishes you for poor accuracy. Getting back to the story that we told, it so often determines the game, so that's what the rating system takes into account. If you have a really accurate... So that's where Mason Cox... I would have Mason Cox as an elite player 4 or 5 years ago that we had, right? But he came out as an elite because he was really accurate in front of goal.
Right.
So if you can understand the rating system, you go, well, that's why, but he's not an elite key forward, but that's why he came out so high, because he was so accurate in front of goal.
Sometimes fans pick something that the broader conversation doesn't. But the D's conversation was inaccurate mid-year.
Mm.
Port Adelaide in a monsoon. Geelong in a pissing rain. Alice Springs was unbelievably bad conditions. Yep. And then they played under the roof at St Kilda, and then I hear the conversation, oh, it looks like they've straightened themselves up. Well, yeah, all of a sudden they're playing in decent conditions.
Couldn't agree more with you. I think I was saying during that time, you just didn't need to panic about Melbourne's offence during that period. They were doing a lot right. That's where the expected score sort of comes back to it. And that's where Simon Goodwood, he would have been referencing to his group.
The expected scores in bring weather into account? Like, if it's fucking horrific and Charlie Kono's 25 metres out directly in front, but there's a gale wind going the other way,
it doesn't take that into account. But you would assume, sort of with wet conditions, that, in general play, a lot of the shots that you're going to be having are going to be under, significant pressure.
Yeah.
And that's where the expected scores comes into account. All set shots, forget doesn't about, matter. If it's blowing a 15K gale or whatever it might be. It's, just forget about that. But if, in general play, if you're under enormous pressure, which, in the wet, you're going to be under enormous pressure a lot of the time, that's where the expected scores sort of comes into it. So they were doing a lot right, Melbourne. And it was actually quite funny, because the first 9 weeks of the year, where they're averaging 110 points a game, they were they were absolutely freakishly accurate.
Yes,
Melbourne in the first 9 weeks of the year. Then they've lost it, and now they've actually got it back reasonably well over the last 7 or 8 weeks. So a lot of what Melbourne has done offensively, Ralphie, which you might be happy, is so similar to 2021. So similar in terms of just the peaks and the troughs of their season.
Do you use Shammy data to predict winners? Like, if happened to be a gambling man.
It took you 30 minutes to get there, Dane.
I'm saying, can you put it in your computers and say, all right, well, average Collingwood would win 7 times out of 10 against Melbourne because of this data, or is it just...
We're trying to get to that. We're sort of trying to get to that. But based off our numbers at the moment, if I was sitting down having a beer with you and I could look at it and go, okay, well, based off our numbers, I'm probably going to be going Collingwood, probably 6 times out of 10 because of X, Y, and Z, if you like. But a lot of our, a lot of our stuff, and it's sort of, really sort of, deep diving, if you like, but it also just comes back to, well, we've got to assume a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you got no idea. So, if we sit down next Thursday night, Collingwood, Melbourne, and you see that Collingwood are just completely off for whatever reason it might be, or Melbourne might be completely off, the numbers have, we can't take that sort of into consideration at all. So a lot of our stuff is based on, well, both teams are going to bring equal effort. Okay. Yep. If that happens, well, then this is what probably could happen.
And can you separate yourself from the data? Like, who would you think the best player in the league is? Like, without looking at the data, the eye test, would yours be so much different to the 10 you've got there? Or
No, it wouldn't be too much. I mean, I'd have Bontempelli as the best player in the competition. I'd have Jack Sinclair, probably top 10.
Yeah.
And then I'll probably have Nick Dacos at number 2.
Yeah.
And then probably Petrarca at number 3.
Yeah.
If you like. We have to do a top 10 and all the lists that anyone does, it just creates that much content, and my Twitter feed just goes banana. So it's just, I get it. But as I was saying at the start, you've got to take the data into consideration, and then take the eye test in consideration, and then, sort of try and marry the two up.
But one thing I noticed with you, but also a couple other punting type data people, all identified that Collingwood just weren't the dominant side that the ladder position was saying, and probably the betting markets too, as far as the premiership market. What did you see in them that made you think, well, hang on, they're on top, because they are on top, they've won the most games, but they're not necessarily dominant?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of our stuff, and the game sort of has changed a little bit over the last 10, 15 years, but it hasn't changed too much. Like, you know, if I go back to, the game significantly changed in 08, 09 and 10. It changed off the back of what Clarkson did with the Clarko cluster in 08, then what Ross Lyon did in 2009 with St Kilda with that immense frontal pressure in 2009, and then off what you guys did in 2010 with that mixed box, I think it was called, just that unbelievable swarm and forward half game, and then everyone just jumped on the back of that.
Yep.
So you have to score off the back of your forward half work, just keep the ball locked in your forward half. That's where the sort of, you know, the game changed, and it hasn't really changed too much, you know, over time. So what Collingwood were doing, this is what I was just, you know, trying to get across, is that, you know, from about round 10 onwards, they were still so dangerous in terms of what they were doing, but they were going against the trend of what we've seen over the last 15 years in terms of what's been successful. A lot of their stuff, and if you just picture Collingwood at their best, is just so hard to stop. It's just this unbelievable ball movement game from the back half where you just see them just absolutely explode and take off, and you're like, how the hell are you absolutely going
to
stop?
Sorry to butt in, but it's on your point. So I watch as just a Nuffy supporter, and I see like a Noble or one or Quainer kick the ball out, and I thought no other team in the league would allow their players to do that.
Mm.
So they embrace mistakes, and I hear that conversation. So what does that actually mean to further your point?
So yeah, so Richmond sort of really started this, I think, in 2006, in 2017, and embracing imperfection.
Right.
So be prepared to make mistakes. Be prepared for the game to be chaotic, and that's fine. We can live with chaos. Don't freeze up and don't panic about making a bad skill error or whatever it might be. Just continue to back yourself. And not, you know, I remember Anzac Day when Braden Maynard had that horrendous kick in that just went straight on Essendon play, and he started laughing.
Yeah.
And Craig McRae started laughing. He was like, "Well, that's perfect. That's exactly what you want. Just don't worry about it. Move on."
Yeah.
And that's what Collingwood embrace. And then the challenge for me, when I was looking at Collingwood's numbers, I was like, "This ball movement game is just freakishly unbelievable." But when it comes up against the best defensive teams in the competition that are trying to lock the ball in their forward half, it's going to be fascinating to see how that actually comes up. So, my Collingwood faithful don't like me. Every time I said it, I said they are the best team in the competition, but they're just not as clear favourite as what everyone else.
So thought. Like the Cats last year, these
off the back of what they were actually doing. So you know, like a Brisbane or a Melbourne who are so strong defensively, it's going to be fascinating to see on Thursday night whether or not Collingwood can get through with this unbelievable ball movement or not. And if they can, well, yeah, good luck to them. But that's so that's where we're sort of coming from with Collingwood, these that they were, and then their contest work was starting to slowly drop off. If you like, and it has really dropped off up until Friday night as well. So it's just, you can go on radio and you could be boring as all hell and just go, Collingwood are good. It's like, everyone knows Collingwood are good. That's fine. Yeah. Everyone knows Collingwood are good. Well, you've got to be a little bit different and bring a little bit different 100%. To the table. So
when your data, who do you expect to be in the grand final? What does Champion Data expect
to me, I think it's. I'll be shocked if it's not one of Melbourne, Collingwood, or Brisbane.
Yeah,
I think those three are a fair way clear of everyone else. That's why that Thursday night game.
Melbourne, yeah, absolutely.
It's just everything.
I think whoever wins that game wins the flag because they got to play Brisbane on the MCG.
Yep. And the Brisbane MCG stuff. I'm not as I'm not as big on that as what a lot of people.
For what
are.
Reason? I'm pretty big on it.
Yeah. Well, I look at what they did against Melbourne in round 18, and Melbourne are the best defensive team in the competition. And then for a 75 minute period, Brisbane put on 100 points against them on the MCG and looked as slick as what Collingwood did at the G. They won a final at the G last year against Melbourne. They lost to Richmond at the G last year, but they were 7 goals in front. So it's not as if, that they've been absolutely horrendous at the G. They're bad against Hawthorn this year, but I think their record is a little bit misleading, and it's a bit of, I call it a little bit of stats abuse. People go back, they've won, one game out of their last 14. Well, they'll shit. From 13 to 18, 19.
They get half started on that.
So we're coming at it from the same angle that, and I often say this in horse racing, stats is a really good way of losing money.
Yeah.
And the thing is with horse racing, in the only thing that interests me, they're very nice to Pat and all that, but is you test your theories pretty well if you lose money. So you go, no, I don't want that. So often, this horse hasn't won for 400 days. Yeah, but it's come second to fucking hate, like caviar three times.
Yep.
So, you know, you got to actually just say, do the numbers back up a stat, because a stat is static.
Yeah, and it is interesting, Ralphie, too. Like, yeah, the numbers, you can take it in any way, and you can slice it in any way that you want to suit the narrative that you're actually trying to get across. You can manipulate it however you want to. So you've got to be really careful in that situation, or, you know, creative, if you like, in some situations as well.
Now, I'm praying you're on the same page, and this hasn't come from you, but I see it, and it just does my self-described Asperger's head in. Tell me quarters one isn't a thing.
No, I honestly couldn't tell you who's won.
Quarters?
Yeah, quarters this year.
Thank you.
I couldn't tell you, to be honest.
Because it tends to be...
It's there, but I haven't.
The whole game's probably important.
I very rarely look at it.
I've never seen you associated with quarters one, because I like beauty, because like Winks only won five quarters when winning... Four Cox Plates. It's about the whole entire game.
Yeah, and that's about 120 minutes. I couldn't tell you, Ralphie.
Just quickly, I think because we're pressed for time, just one that I wanted to personally ask you about, the importance of adjusting your thinking from your end. And by that, I've heard when Damien Hardwick stepped down, he said he made us change the way we think because you brought in new metrics just because you're going, well, hang on, our metrics aren't necessarily working compared to what he's doing, because what he's doing is working. And maybe Craig McRae was... early doors with Collingwood was making the number. You know, I was saying to Dane at the time, if a team is winning against all the numbers, well, maybe the numbers
looking at. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you constantly got to be open to the fact that, you know, the season changes week after week after week, and you hear a lot of coaches talk about, you know, that game styles and game plans often change over a 4, 5, 6 week period. So you're constantly adjusting your thinking based off what the numbers are actually sort of telling you.
So what were the metrics with Dimmer that you brought in?
So Hardwick changed the whole game in terms of he didn't want to prioritise the stoppage and clearance game. He wanted to prioritise the turnover and transition game. So he wasn't too fussed about actually winning clearance. They were a terrible.
Had Sean Brigg in the ruck in the granny.
Oh, terrible. He didn't prioritise it. So that was 17th and 18th in clearance in 17, 18, 19. Their contested possession numbers were 12th, 13th, 14th. But everything outside of the clearance situation, that's where we had to bring in different measures to be able to actually start analysing what Richmond were doing.
Yes.
Because we started looking at it going, geez, what's actually happening here? How can you be winning, you know, sort of game after game by, you know, sort of ranking 15th, 16th, 17th in this area? And then we broke down the game into what's happening at stoppage and what's happening outside of stoppage. And then it was like, so they're 16th, 17th and 18th at stoppage, and then they're 1, 2 and 3. Outside of stoppage, that's the game that they're prioritising. That's what they wanted. Then you go and watch a Richmond game, you're like, okay, well, Nick Vlosten is set up behind the ball as a loose. They're actually outnumbered at stoppage. Oh, they're actually happy with that, because they'll lose that clearance. Vlosten will then win it, and then boom.
Right.
They're off. And it was like, that's the game that they wanted to. So often everyone would be talking about contest and clearance. Like, you know, you've got to win contested possession and clearance. You've got to be hard and tough and all this sort of stuff. And Dimmer's like, no, we're not going to do that. We've actually got speed. Yeah. Let's play the speed game and let's actually change the way that we actually want to play.
So in the end, what you're saying is your numbers are matching up with the coach saying, let's coach to what our strengths are.
Yes, spot on.
Which will never change.
Yeah, spot on. Maximising his list, and he did it probably better than anyone else.
Super. Really appreciate you coming in. So every Tuesday night on SEN, you heard anywhere else?
Yeah, and then Pure Footy with David King on a Wednesday on the Herald Sun website.
Super. Love what you do and really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you. No worries, guys. Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Swanee a wrap.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.